and welcome to the Adfontes podcast. My name is Ansi Kamel. I am an editor-at-large at the journal Adfontes, and I'm joined, as always, by my two co-hosts, Colin Chan-Redimer, the poetry editor of Adfontes, and Reese Laverty, senior editor of the entire operation. Gentlemen, it's great to be here with you.
Always a pleasure.
Very good to be back together. Ansi, you're back from a profound pilgrimage, yeah?
Profound pilgrimage. That's right. Fresh off the mean streets of Cairo. But yeah, I went to Egypt with my family for the first time recently. It was a great trip. I'll have to fill you in about it sometime. But right now we have more important things, actually probably less important things to talk about. No offense, Colin.
Ouch.
But we're going to talk about his modernization. Colin's forthcoming / soon to be released. Whenever this
it might be released when this
is
drops.
This will be out beforehand. So this is the publicity. This
That's
is
right.
the pre-publication.
So keep your eyes peeled, folks, for Colin's modernization of Traherne's Christian ethics. And so, Colin, I'll level with you and with our listeners. Maybe our listeners know who this guy is, but I thought to myself, okay, I work for Davenant. I've studied a lot. Not as much as some people, but a lot. And I have no idea who this guy is. And if I don't know who this guy is, can anyone besides our listeners be expected to know who this guy is? So, I open the intro to the book and I start reading. And the first sentence, Colin, you say that C.S. Lewis said that he had some of the best prose maybe ever written in English. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. I can't wait to read this. Oh, wait, it's a modernization. No, I'm not actually going to get to read his prose. So, Colin, I don't know who this guy is. I'm not getting the original prose. What's the purpose of this book? And who is this guy? Too small.
Yeah,
questions.
No, these are very good questions. I take the same shot at myself, I think, later in the introduction, where I make fun of the fact that I once gave somebody a hard time in a review of their book for modernizing an author, Thomas Dekker, from roughly the same era. It's a little bit after this era. So I thoroughly enjoy and relish the irony at various levels. And one of the things I tried hard to do in comparison to Brad's modernization of Richard Hooker, which if you do some comparisons of kind of the before and after, I would say this has a much gentler hand comparatively, simply because Traherne's writing he's a poet. I mean, he was clearly thinking about the writing as much as, if not more than, he was thinking about the arguments and, the audience that he's interacting with.
Hooker, if people have read the Hooker modernizations we've done, Brad's pointed out before, I think, that Hooker writes English as if he's writing Latin. With these incredibly long sentences, and everything is kind of predicated on clauses that are like half a mile away. And I worked on one of the Hooker modernizations, and trying to keep that long sentence style together in modern English is kind of like trying to hold wet tissue paper together. It's just very fragile, delicate operation. But this, he writes English as if he's writing English and writing poetic English at that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it would be more like in the vein of modernizations of Shakespeare, and that does happen nowadays, which is sad and pathetic. And I relish the irony and the smirk,
but not I.
After growing from Ansi Kamel, but if you go look at those, and I did look at a few of them, they tend to far overdo it, right? I don't have an example off the top of my head, but it's like to be or not to be. That is the question. It's like, should I kill myself or not? It's like, this is a bad modernization, because you've grasped at least one part of the meaning, but you haven't, given any weight or attention to the poetical meter in which it's written. So if you want to modernize something like that, you have to think of yourself doing a translation from English to English. And that's how Davenant explains its role doing this stuff, is we really are trying to translate and preserve English. And when I talk to my students, my undergrads, and they tell me how they're struggling with writing and this and that, I always tell them, you're going through something like the Great Vowel Shift. We're really entering a phase, I think, where the English language is going to, people will look back on this era of mass internet adoption and recognize this as one of those moments where the English language shifts in a way that it hasn't for 500 years or so. and or for, you know, like occasionally, right, these seasons come up and you have a major shift in a short period of time, and the other end of it, it's hard to kind of read stuff that came before it. Middle English, right, very hard for us. Old English is basically incomprehensible without significant training. And so, you know, what does it look like to try to preserve modern English for the modern English of the future? And that's the question of that the whole series is trying to answer. And when you're dealing with something like Shakespeare, you know, the King James Bible, Traherne, I think it's a worthwhile project. Mm-hmm. And then secondarily, if I had to defend the project, you know, they're just, as with many of the books Davenant publishes, there aren't accessible copies of these texts at a reasonable price point that include things like footnotes and introductions that can help the average American reader of English, you know, just dig in and appreciate and make use of the work.
Yeah. Yeah. So why Traherne? Like, I mean, you started recounting, I mean, I was sort of, you know, giving you a hard time for your introduction. But it was thoroughly engrossing, actually, because you recount this very fascinating history of the reception of these texts and the identity of Traherne as an author of these texts. So maybe can you just tell us a little bit about that, and then, you know, tell us why you think this text in particular is so significant as to warrant... Is this our only modernization besides Richard Hooker? I mean...
John Jewell.
Oh, yeah, right.
Is Jewell modernization?
No, Jewell's not modernized.
Yeah, so these are... Collins alluded to the series. This is within the Davenant Press stable. We have the Library of Early English Protestantism, which, as it says on the tin, is a collection of texts from the early English Protestant Reformation. So a big part of that is our Richard Hooker modernization project. But then we also have other texts in there, such as John Jewell's Apology of the Church of England, Jurisdiction, Regal Episcopal Papal by George Carleton.
I think the spelling in the Jewell one might be modernized.
Maybe the spelling, not the language, yes. It's a series of historic texts with, like Colin said, intros and footnotes. Not all of them are modernizations. Thus far, only Richard Hooker has been kind of fully modernized in the prose. And now, in that illustrious company, we have Collins' modernization of Thomas Traherne's Christian Ethics, Volume 1 of 4, we should say, as well. So this is the first volume of what's going to be 4, which we'll eventually collect, as we have done with the first part of Hooker's Laws. Yes. Sorry, that's Colin.
Yeah, so initially, actually, to talk about kind of how it ended up in my lap, when I was brought on, you know, there was some question. I was one of the first teaching fellows who was actually working more or less full-time for Davenant, and being paid for my work, and so they wanted me to do stuff, and so part of the stuff, you know, this is several years ago now. You know,
should have had a union, Colin.
I should. If I had had a union, I wouldn't have had a union.
He is the union.
Don't
see.
No one's going to make you do anything.
And initially, Brad had said, "Take a look at this John Jewell and see if you want to do some work with it." And I read it, and I thought, you know, it's a brilliant work. It's really interesting. Is a lot more Latin than my Latin, which is, you know, non-existent in that. And it just was not something, I just said, this is not realistically something that I think is going to be ideal for me. And at the same time, somebody else had been doing a little bit of work, just kind of gathering the ideas of what Traherne would be like. And I think there was a little Word doc that had just been put together. It wasn't at all modernized. And so I got an email back from Brad that said, "Well, take a look at Traherne." And as soon as I saw Traherne, I knew the name already, which was already a good sign.
Because he's mentioned Philistines and Oiks.
Yeah. You've read
his
name.
Why are you insulting our listeners, our very well educated and intelligent listeners?
I'm very happy for the
Philistines
and Oiks.
Our very well educated listeners have actually read the name Traherne before, because they have read The Abolition of Man. And in The Abolition of Man, of the authors who C.S. Lewis recommends as somebody who's making parallel arguments or that could help you out of the modern conundrum is Thomas Traherne.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. That's fascinating.
And that's not the only place that Lewis mentions him. So he's mentioned in the Lewisanian corpus several times, most extensively in the letters.
Mm. Okay.
Whenever people send letters to C.S. Lewis and ask him, you know, "I really love your stuff. What else should I read? Where can I go from here?" Particularly if they're asking about kind of spiritual direction or discipleship, you know, or devotional literature, universally he recommends Traherne as one of the first people off of his list.
It's in his letters. It comes up several times in his letters to his friend Arthur Greaves, who is Lewis's best friend. He comes up in Surprised by Joy, if people remember a bit in Surprised by Joy, where Lewis uncharacteristically goes over the road to visit a boy who's ill in bed, and they discover they're both into like dragons and unicorns and whatever. And so we have their letters, well, Lewis's letters to Greaves anyway, from that, from like 1914, 1916, whatever it is, through to mere weeks before Lewis dies, when Lewis literally, he's like, I'm going to die soon. He nearly dies early in, I think, 63, and then says, yeah, I'm probably going to die soon. I'll never see you again. Several times now that Traherne is mentioned, and it's such a like proper thing you do with your friends. Every time I think in those letters, Lewis recommends Traherne to Arthur Greaves, he's clearly forgotten he's recommended him before.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. So the other question you asked, Anzi, is just about the man himself and his reception and the value of this as a document. And are all, you know, fascinating questions, and I get into it in the introduction. And there's actually significant scholarly debate that's currently ongoing, you know, about the textual history, because, you know, various people who played a part in the recovery of some of the Traherne texts and the Traherne, you know, studies cottage industry have fabricated various pieces of this. And so then like other scholars, because you want a good story, right?
Yeah, if you're right.
He was a 17th century pastor, basically, if you want to start with the Traherne story. We don't really know where he was born. We don't really know much about his early life, right? Like most English peasants, he's just kind of the son of some dude named Traherne. But apparently was clever because he got a spot at Oxford. And so that really is what kickstarts his his position in the public scene. From there, he he's born during the English Civil War, we should mention.
Okay.
And so, you know, throughout his education, England is officially, you know, governed by Cromwell, the Lord Protector, and his warts, as Monty Python would say, though I have nothing against him personally.
You have nothing against... Okay.
I mean, he didn't do anything to me.
Well, oh, I see, personally. Yeah. I see. Okay. All right.
And Traherne apparently, you know, has a sort of puritanical streak to him, and not in a, I don't mean that in a negative sense, just that he had some sympathies with the Puritans, the person who was educating him, the college he was being educated in, Credenhill, Credenhill's the name of the church that he is a pastor at after Oxford, but Brasnose, or is Brasnose? I don't know how to pronounce your language. What is it?
Brasnose.
Brasnose. Did I say that right?
I believe so. Although I'm not an Oxford man.
So it is the kind of hot seat for the Puritans while he's at Oxford. Of the colleges, it was the one that was known to have the most Puritan sympathies.
Yeah. And Oxford then, being generally less Puritan and more royalist than
that's
Cambridge.
Right. Yep. That's right. Though, you know, when you know when the king is there, you know, obviously everybody is a subject of the king, and when you've got a Lord Protector, everybody's a subject of the Lord Protector. Yeah, so, I mean, you can go back and look at this very complicated history. One way or another, I think, you know, you get the sense you get in Traherne's own writing is that he's really not interested in politics. Mm-hmm. Politics is clearly very dangerous. This world is a really messed up place. And that actually, I think, isn't just true of his relationship to English politics. I think it's also true of his relationship to church politics. So he can see the ways in which, you know, the political can get involved in the church and have a caustic effect, at least from his perspective. And so, you know, we look back at that period and we think, well, there's like Puritans and there's like Anglicans or, you know, like the Church of England people. But that's not actually a really good depiction of what was going on, because what was actually going on is there's parishes. And all the parishes, you know, more or less, most of them have some relationship to the Church of England. And, you know, inside of those parishes, some of them tend to be more informed by the Puritan or the Reformed, you know, positions, and some are more Anglo-Catholic, much like it is today, right? I mean, I'm not in the Church of England, but I have friends who've attended, and you have some that are sort of more evangelical and you have some that are more, you know, high church, some that are very anti-papist but high church, some that are very you know, happy to play patty cake with the Pope. And all that stuff that we see nowadays, and it's so clear to us, we forget that we need to project that back onto the like time as it existed. So he becomes a pastor at Creedon Hill, and initially, we don't know why, doesn't get officially ordained by the Church of England. He's just kind of operating as a pastor under like a lay ordination for several years. And then once Cromwell is deposed and you have the Restoration, he gets ordained in the Church of England. And you just get the sense that this is a guy who's not interested in you know, that aspect. He's interested in the care of souls. He's interested in the ideas. He's clearly interested in his education. He goes for three separate degrees at Oxford. So even while he's a pastor, he's continued to be a scholar. And over the course of his life, he really only publishes under his own name two works. And actually, that's even a mistake. So he publishes one work in his own life, which is Against Roman Forgeries. So in spite of being not interested in church politics, he has a very clear sense of why it is that he's not a Roman Catholic, why he is a Protestant. But he is a person who represents, I think, something Davenant cares a lot about, which is this sense of the magisterial Protestantism, that there's a family of Protestant churches which hangs together in a very significant way, which is distinct from Roman Catholicism. And he would fit inside that trajectory. I mean, I could just keep going, but I figure it should be a little bit more conversational. So not sure if there's any sort of piece of that you want me to pick up on or where you want me to go from there.
Well, so I worked on the editing of this with Colin. On that point then, this text, Christian Ethics, as a kind of showcase of the Protestant tradition as continuous with what's gone before it, you know, it's not reinventing the wheel. One of the ways that the Reformation and Protestantism is obviously, well, not obvious, won't be obvious if you don't know, one of the ways Protestantism and the Reformation is often pitted against everything that came before it is for people to say that the Roman Catholics and the medieval era were all obsessed with virtue ethics, which they get from Aristotle, and this pagan idea of virtue, ultimately, the bankruptcy of virtue ethics and its inability to make man just is what leads Martin Luther to be plagued with doubt and lack of assurance over his salvation. And then he rediscovers the gospel and bang. You know, I've heard presidents of venerable theological colleges make those statements in lecturing on the Reformation, that, you know, the Reformation is all about the bankruptcy of virtue ethics on one level. Yet you crack open Traherne here, and the idea of virtue and what virtue is, and virtue is a kind of fusty old word like codpiece or gauntlet.
Not quite exactly like codpiece, actually. That was my recommendation for the cover image.
The massive codpiece.
It was rejected.
Yeah, it's just one of these kind of old fusty words that, and actually we don't really know what it means or what it's for. Very literally there. So we hear virtue, we don't quite get what it is, but virtue is all over Christian ethics, certainly this first volume that we're putting out. And Aristotle is in there as well, mentioned explicitly, but often, I think actually when Aristotle comes up in this, is Traherne saying, Aristotle, he says, get some things right by, you know, a lucky hit. I think it's how it's rendered. I think that's actually Traherne's original phrasing, not even Colin adjusting it. But what Traherne's really concerned about is happiness, what human happiness is and how human happiness is achieved and what the perfect, glorified human being looks like and is, and kind of philosophically how you can kind of define it. And that's where we get our subtitle from, The Shining Human Creature, all this imagery that Traherne has, especially towards the end of this volume, of, you know, a person as God designed them to be is just shining with glory. And you look around all other people, and if they're as they're meant to be, they're shining as well. And isn't that amazing? It's kind of like the opposite of being in The Great Divorce, where everyone is kind of thin and see-through, and the grass is too real for their feet. So Traherne is stepping into this tradition of virtue ethics very clearly, but it is possibly one of the most obvious examples I've seen of a Christian saying, yes, Aristotle gets this stuff right, but he also gets loads of stuff really wrong, because he doesn't know actually kind of how you get there. And he is concerned with happiness sort of itself rather than happiness in God. I think that's maybe the kind of big
one. And your
takeaway from it.
your point there about the Great Divorce is quite telling, just to circle back and comment on this issue of his relationship to Lewis. Because, you know, when you read Traherne, you see something that Lewis makes thematic, but I think the theme is actually present in Traherne, and if Lewis doesn't get it from him, you know, they're getting it from the same source, which is like reality or something, but he certainly loves seeing it in Traherne, and you can see that in some of his letters and conversations too, that you know, reality is real and good, but reality with God is more real.
Mm.
It's more good. It's better. It's this kind of magnification and this kind of sparkling, this glow, this intensification of the experience, and that comes through on almost every page that you read of Traherne. That he loves life, and it's also, it's not because he's successful. So I think this is a major difference as well. Is it would be easy to kind of read Lewis and hear him say things like that and say, well, yeah, if I was an international best-selling author and like got to kind of casually hang out with J.R.R. Tolkien at like my favorite pub 2 days a week, and like life is just working splendidly for this chap, you know, maybe I would also say that reality with God is more good than reality without God. It's more real than reality without God. But Traherne died, you know, he was so poor that his will was like, give my brother my favorite hat and walking stick. And like, that was like the extent of what he had left, right? He was also basically ignored and forgotten. So he
died as sort of private chaplain to his benefactor.
The Lord Chancellor. He was, you know, basically living at his house, and they would just kind of talk. And I think Traherne was a happy guy, but unmarried, no kids, no money. He published one book in his life that under his own name that basically sold no copies. He was almost done. He finished Christian Ethics, and then they sent it to the publisher, and he and his patron both die before it gets published, which means there's no subsequent publications. There's nobody to promote the book. There's no audience from the first book that could get him to care about this book. And then he has a pile of other writings that like could never find a publisher, right? It's a classic story of writers who have, you know, great talent, but no one to champion their stuff. And maybe they don't have the knack for self-promotion. And so those papers just kind of molder and float around the like, you know, high society people who like to hang out with papers. And then, you know, this is the story that's highly contested. There's a book, a book merchant who's just wandering through the like the bin of like, you know, $1 books and papers and things that are about to be thrown out, you know, if like nobody buys them, just sitting on the street. Mm-hmm. And he finds this manuscript and he says, holy shnikes, this is amazing. You know, this is like hundreds of years after Traherne's dead, buys the thing, takes it home, and then identifies one line of poetry from that, because occasionally Traherne will break into poetry in his own books, of his own original verse, and identifies that piece of poetry and says, I think I've read that somewhere before. Traherne had published at least one book already anonymously, which, you know, was probably better read than Roman forgeries, but didn't put his name on it in his lifetime. This guy finds this line, sees that the line is a quote from this thing which was published anonymously, but that thing which was published anonymously mentions the patron who had basically sponsored the book, the Lord Chancellor. And then they look up that guy and they say, this guy had this chaplain who wrote Roman forgeries. And then they, by digging around, they basically uncover it's a pile of Traherne's writings in his own hand. And he's one of only two, you know, major writers from that era whose writings we have in his own hand, the other being John Milton, who dies, you know, almost at the exact same time as Traherne. So they're contemporaries. And so those books actually are the Centuries of Meditations and then his works of poetry. Those become kind of a big hit around 1900. And so like 1900 to 1950, that's how Lewis runs into him. There's a, you know, a resurgence of kind of Anglican intellectual life that's not unrelated to Lewis. And Lewis is deeply informed by the Centuries of Meditation. And that's how people know him. So people who know who Thomas Traherne is know him for one of two reasons. Usually one is the Centuries of Meditation, which is a great work of kind of mystical and meditative stuff. And that's what actually Lewis recommends people to go read. Mm. That's where they want him to start. When they say, who should I read? He says, read Trajan's Centuries of Meditation. If that's not
he doesn't like his poetry, Lewis.
Yeah, he does knock his poetry. He's not a huge fan. But or people will know him from his
poetry in that era was kind of weird. Like, if you read, like, Henry Moore's poetry, it was very influential, terrible, just really bizarre, like, just so bad. Emerson loved it. Anyone who's alive today, if you say you love it, I'm like, what are you on, guys? You know.
Yeah, so he gets lumped in with the metaphysical poets, and that's what you're referencing. And so he's doing
Moore
this
is one of the metaphysical poets. Yeah.
This poetic philosophy stuff, and the truth of the matter is, he's not in the first rank, right? So everybody who sort of puts him in that school, which I think is the right move to be in the metaphysical poets, you know, he's like maybe he's top 5 to top 10 somewhere in there, but he's not the first guy you would send people to. And that whole genre might not be to your taste, right?
Yeah. So the the way that you're talking about Traherne's biography, you know, he's not interested in church politics. He's not interested in secular, i.e. worldly politics. He's interested in the cultivation of virtue. I guess I'm wondering, to what degree do you see him as part of a broader movement of people sort of turning inward? I mean, so Henry Moore is another figure kind of like this, you know, educated at Cambridge and turns away from politics and ecclesial stuff. He has non-Puritan sympathies, but like doesn't really care that much and writes like on metaphysics and virtue. And like, that's like his. So to what degree should we see like Traherne as like an example, maybe a particularly, you know, learned or instructive example, but just one example nonetheless of just the kind of zeitgeist of his moment.
Do you mean this sort of post Civil War, right? Everybody, you know, again, remains the deadliest thing to ever happen in England, utterly destroys the country to an extent that just English people today barely can fathom. And so after that, there's this kind of apolitical turn. Is that sort of what you're...
Yeah, this kind of apolitical turn, but also, I mean, it's not just apolitical. It's there's this inner turn about the cultivation of virtue, but also this kind of like turn toward I'm trying to think of how to put it, like metaphysical virtuous mysticism. There's this sort of like kind of this triumvirate of metaphysics, mysticism, and virtue. And they're like, there's a really intense focus on these sorts of topics in that time period. I mean, do you have a feel for like how Traherne should be located in that kind of milieu? Is he just sort of doing the same thing? Is he different in particular ways? Like, what's kind of his project?
Yeah. The easy answer is no, I do not. But I that's not going to stop me from having thoughts. When I was reading him and initially working on this project, you know, this is not my period. So that's the first thing that should just be said. And so there's certainly going to be other people out there who I'm hoping can answer that question more fully of kind of how do you place him in among 17th century, you know, philosophy. There are people who want to put him in with the Cambridge Platonists. There are people who sort of think that that's the right move.
My hunch isn't wrong that he can be sort of seen this way.
There are people who definitely will make that claim. You know, what I say in the introduction to The Shining Human Creature is that while people read him as a Platonist and they are not wrong to say that he is doing something with Plato, there's all this evidence, including just explicit references where he's praising Aristotle for being writer than Aristotle would have even known. As well as there's one paper, which it was published in New Blackfriars in 1931, Blackfriars being the Dominicans. This is kind of a Dominican, an Oxford Dominican journal by a scholar who's wrong about all kinds of things, but I think has done a very convincing, like detailed work in a paper called St. Thomas Aquinas and Thomas Traherne. She basically lays out passages of prose from the Summa, side by side in the translations, you know, that are available at the time, side by side with Thomas Traherne talking about similar issues, and says whether she's not accusing him of plagiarism, but she's saying he is organizing these sets of ideas, you know, and sometimes, you know, just prose wise, like writing through the idea in the same way that you see Thomas doing in the Summa.
Yeah.
That doesn't make him a Thomist in the technical 21st century sense, but it does make him a student of Thomas in a way that I don't know that you see as explicitly. I obviously haven't studied the Cambridge Platonists as much as I've studied Traherne.
Right.
But it's not the kind of thing that you think of when you think of, you know, the Platonic revival. My next edition of this, my next volume, because I've already covered his biography and some of this other material, what I actually want to do is something like what you're talking about, which is think about his place in the tradition of Christian ethics.
Okay.
You know, what do we mean by Christian ethics? Who are the thinkers? And one of the things I suspect, actually, and I'm working on a paper along these lines for a conference this spring, is that there's actually not as much distance between him and even people like, you know, Rene Descartes, as we might think, that there's something going on in that early modern period where, in general, people are sort of turning to these metaphysical questions and asking themselves what the relationships of those things are to, you know, even the practical problems of everyday life, and trying to come up with new and interesting solutions. And what Traherne would represent, my theory is at the moment, in relation to that, is someone who's attempting, maybe in a more fulsome way than, or a more explicit way than you see with Descartes and other modern philosophy, to hang on to the tradition as he moves forward into, you know, the modern era. But I don't know that for a certainty. So that's stuff that I'm working on this spring and summer.
That's great.
Well, that volume may be endorsed by, you know, resident Henry Moore expert Auntie Aaron Camel by the time it
generalizes. I guess we'll see.
It'd be hilarious if he refused to endorse it.
No, because Henry Moore is, anyway, that's getting too far afield. But I just find him a very strange dude. He's a very strange dude. He's really smart. But I am not his champion, so...
If you've no idea who Henry Moore is or what his whole shtick was, Onsi did a fantastic Davenant Fellows lecture about him, which we'll link to in the show notes, and has a superb poster and thumbnail on YouTube, if nothing else, of the Helter Skelter in the cathedral. None of that was the best thing about it. But.
Thanks.
I've got a question in our last bit of time on this before we begin to wrap up. So it's Colin, the subtitle... the shining human creature. As I read through this the first time you sent it through, and then subsequently while we've been working on it, I think one of the particularly striking things for me is this, and in the way that we've kind of sold the book and blurbed it, we have mentioned that it's an anthropological text. In many ways. So one of the things that really struck me was this incredibly high view of the person, of human beings, that Traherne has, his incredibly high view of what the soul is, and what God made the soul to be, and its capacities and its powers, which, to talk about Lewis again, put me in mind of, you know, when Lewis talks about the fact that you need to remember you're always in the presence of immortal beings whenever you're around another human being. And is it even, is it him in that same stretch? He says, you know, if you could sort of see how perfect and glorious this person, you know, could be as God made them, you'd want to fall down and worship them. That's the overriding sense I got out of Traherne, which I found odd that struck me, because so we would like to say now that we live in kind of an age where man has divorced himself from God, and our man sets the tone, man has exalted himself. And yet, in a man-centric age, we actually end up, of course, having a very low view of man, which, Lewis, again, we've abolished man. And even though man is kind of running away with himself, he's actually then kind of cut off the branch that he's sitting on because he has no kind of account for just what a glorious creature right. he is. So I don't know if you could kind of speak to that as a theme in Traherne and what Traherne, why it is that Traherne comes out with this vision of a shining human creature.
Yeah, the back of the book, I think, says something about anthropology. And initially when it was sent to me for approval, I said, it is about anthropology, but you can't do a Christian anthropology without a Christian theology. So you have to mention God. That
this was good feedback to get when we were drafting the blurb. Needs more God. Yeah.
Well, when, you know, so I would say for the title or the subtitle, The Shining Human Creature, you know, this is actually not a phrase that appears anywhere in Traherne. Mm. So that's worth saying, first of all. But I will defend to the hilt that it is a faithful expression of what Traherne's getting at. And the reason is as follows. What Traherne seems to be trying to do is preserve the best of the ancient conception of virtue ethics and the Christian doctrine of God and his sovereignty over all things. And so I think the title puts those two things together in this way, that Traherne throughout his text, he does mention God, but he talks a lot about how great, you know, humans are, how great life is, how great we can and ought to and should and will be. And he does all of this by talking about virtue, which of course, you know, we know arete translates to excellence, but it has this kind of quality of glory also in the translation. Or of shining and shimmering, mm-hmm. and catching the eye, right? If you're watching a foot race, you know, at the Olympics or whatever, the person out front is the one that catches the eye during the race, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the excellent one. And so the shining is a reference to virtue that I hope can break through some of the more stodgy, you know, iced over feelings we have when we hear somebody trying to talk to you about virtue, right? I mean, like a codpiece. If you'd put a codpiece on the front, it would catch the eye, you know, something shining.
I meant more that it's a fusty old word rather than that it catches the eye.
Oh, no.
It would catch the eye.
I think there's something shining about it. It would definitely stand out. So the shining is a reference to the virtue, and then the human creature, I think, is helpful because, as you would see, maybe more so in the centuries of meditations, but certainly it's there present in the Christian ethics. Creature implies two things. One is that there must be a creator, and so we tend to say creature, and you think little creepy crawly thing. But the Christian tradition of theological reflection would say, well, if you say creature, you're talking about it always in reference to that which created it. And the human creature recognizes the intrinsic relatedness of humans as creatures, not just to God, but to all other creatures. And so there's a little bit of the St. Francis, I think, in Thomas Traherne, not in that he's at all sympathetic with the Pope or anything, but just that, you know, brother, sun, sister, moon, you know, preaching to the birds. You know, Traherne definitely had a real vivid sense of life and his connection as a living thing to all these other things. Supposedly he was very free with his money, you know, to whoever came to him. And so the shining human creature, I think, puts those things together, right? We're going to talk about virtue, but we're going to talk about virtue particularly related to that thing under God's sovereignty, which he put at the pinnacle and the heart of all of creation, which is you, listener. It's you. I mean, I really think that's what Traherne is trying to get at in this book. And he addresses it. It really is, I think, his life's work. So it's a shame that we don't give it more attention, because it's the one book that he put out trying to really express his thought and his words to the church that he had given his life in service to as a pastor. So he's intending this to be read, you know, to and for and by Christians for their edification, so that they can learn how to think about themselves correctly, right? If you think that you're kind of a schmuck or a scumbag, you know, there's not much hope for you, if that's really what you think of yourself, for learning how to grow up and be better. Traherne is like the coach who's trying to give you a good name to live up to. Mm. You know, he's trying to encourage you that, you know, you've really got some talent here at being a decent human. You know, God made you in this way that you could.
This is the Goodwill Hunting of 17th century theology.
That's right.
Text.
It's not your fault, listeners. It's
not
your fault.
It is, but it's okay.
Go ahead for a hug. So it's not entirely, you know, your fault. And it just got, you know, God made you. He loves you. He's redeeming you. It's all in there. So it's just steeped in the gospel and also steeped in really good writing. And as somebody who cares about good writing, you know, that matters to me too. I can't imagine working on a text like this if you didn't enjoy reading them.
Yeah, that's great. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Colin, for this project. Thank you for that kind of stirring, you know, exposition of Traherne's thought. We're going to wrap it up there and move to the what we're reading section. So, Rhys, what have you been reading?
Have I been reading? Well, as some listeners may know, we've seen it already, I am trying to follow Matthew J. Frank's Shakespeare in a Year reading plan.
Oof.
Yeah. You know, there's been people might forget by the time this comes out, but a furore on Twitter about, you know, trying to read too many good books in a year and whatnot. Well, hey, read a play because they're much shorter. And it still looks impressive. If you say I read the whole of Shakespeare this year.
And I made it through, you know, January, and like halfway through February, I fell apart. So.
Yeah, I just
I can't, you know, deal. I need more variety than that. Like that much of any one author. I can't. Yeah, I don't know. Good luck, Rhys.
Yeah,
good luck.
Yeah, we'll see. But the thing is, I've read most of Shakespeare already. And some Shakespeare that I do love, so you know, I can kind of take it a bit easy. I think when I get to the ones that I already know fairly well, but it's more of a way of trying to get through ones that I haven't read. So yeah, we'll see. I had no other New Year ideas, and then I saw this like, that actually seems quite fun. And plays, you know, even though Shakespeare plays again. Fairly sure. I'm doing it in bed most nights for like, you know, 20 minutes, you read an act, so it's fine. I'm trying to kind of blog my way through it on my Funtas blog as well. So, so that's as at time of recording, I have done, Two Gentlemen of Verona, which, I'd never done before and is a sort of very overlooked because it is generally thought to be early and sort of, it's kind of full of elements that get repackaged in other romantic Shakespeare stories, whether comedies or tragedies. You know, there's a Friar Lawrence, there's a rope ladder, there's, you know, disguise, this and the other. And Taming of the Shrew, which, like, is maybe an Comedy of Errors might be like this when I get to it, but sort of atypical example of how Shakespeare comedies aren't that funny to read, but are more funny to watch. Yes, although I've also got to take me through W.H. Auden's lectures on Shakespeare, which are kind of reconstructed from some comprehensive notes that one of his students, and I think eventual assistant, took during the lectures that he delivered. And these lectures were crazy. Like, they sold out. People came from hours away to hear Auden lecture on Shakespeare in the States back in the day.
Wait, is this in a book?
Yeah.
You have this?
Yeah.
What book?
It's just called Auden on Shakespeare, I think. Yeah,
I think I get book recommendations. reading. This is great. I'm buying that.
But he says The Taming of the Shrew is the only Shakespeare play that is a complete failure. Maybe Titus Andronicus, but definitely this one.
That's great.
Because he says it's a farce, and Shakespeare basically isn't very good at farce. Ben Jonson would have been better at it if he'd written it, but he didn't. So,
nice.
That's where I'm at.
Nice. Very good.
That's great.
Colin, what are you reading?
I am teaching at Davenant Hall right now a Nietzsche seminar, and maybe we'll do a conversation here on Nietzsche at some point. I think we were texting each other that might be a fun idea.
We were, and I'm gutted that I cannot take this class because I've maxed out my philosophy credits at Davenant Hall already, largely on Colin. So I can't be in his
thank
class.
You. Okay. I appreciate that. This class, you know, it's. I think it might be the most well attended. It's certainly the most well attended one. I don't know if it has the most enrolled students because, you know, oftentimes enrolled students are just watching it later on, right? They're not actually showing up. But people, I mean, we had 20 people there on a Zoom call, which is a lot for a Zoom call. And I ended my lecture by trying to exhort them. You know, if you could do one thing to help you read Nietzsche well, what should you do? And I said, you know, it's not read this secondary source, that secondary source. It's not, you know, read it twice. It's grow a mustache. And the reason is twofold. One, he actually writes about, he writes the philosophy of the mustache. I mean, he writes about it in his books. A mustache is a mask, is the famous phrase that he uses a number of times. But it also represents military discipline. And those two things, I think, the military discipline is not about, you know, let's go conquer, you know, Poland. That's not what he means. His interest in military discipline is about what it does internal to the life of the person in the military, right? That it teaches you something that you can express later on about the will to power, about the power of routines, about how to comport yourself in really difficult, trying situations, which he thinks you're going to need in life. Mm-hmm. But then also it's a mask, both in the sense that it's a way of lying to people about what you look like, but also it's a mask in the sense that it's kind of playful. And his philosophy, I think, is doing both of those things. He's lying to you sometimes. He's hiding from you sometimes. Also, he's playing with you sometimes. And he's trying to sort of instill this disciplined life in you. So anyhow, that's just a sneak peek into what I've been up to. And it's been a delight. I've read a lot of Nietzsche over my time. I've taught Nietzsche before for, you know, a week here or there with undergrads. I have never done anything like trying to just do a deep dive with grad students, so.
That's great. Yeah, awesome. Nietzsche's always a lot of fun. For my part, I'm on break right now, so I've been kind of trying to read novels. So I've been doing a tour through some of the greats of American literature that I haven't had time to read. So I'm focusing kind of in like the early 20th century, you know, kind of that sort of post-World War I scene. So I read Hemingway. So Hemingway, A Farewell to Arms was the one that I read, because I've read some other Hemingway. You know, The Old Man in the Sea, it's good. Yeah. It's good. The Sun Also Rises, it's good. Farewell to Arms, though, the first, like, third, the prose really annoyed me. And then after that, it kind of just clicked. And, you know, maybe it was that Hemingway, I always sort of feel... Sometimes his prose, you know, you can tell he's trying. It's clearly, it's like artifice. There's a sort of like, and that's true of all prose, but his prose is just so distinctive and so different. And sometimes it doesn't quite work, but the back two thirds of this book, the prose works and the story is honest and true. And it was just fantastic. So I was really enjoying
I always
that.
Describe him as a Cabernet that needs to be aged. It's a little, it's like a really good Cabernet, but it's always a little young. It's just tight, you know.
No,
just,
that's exactly. Yeah,
it's got to open up.
Got to breathe. Yep.
Yeah, it's got to breathe.
That confirms like a hunch I always had about Hemingway, because we did The Old Man and the Sea at school for my GCSE. It was like, you know, 15, 16, high school diploma, whatever it is. Equivalent. And my English teacher hated it, but I think it was like, of all the things on the assigned texts, like, was the one he sort of hated the least, so he chose it. But I just remember the first lesson on it at like start of year 10, he just goes, "Boys," yeah, he had a really nasal voice, Mr. Peter, "boys, we'll be studying The Old Man and the Sea, which is a book about a man, a fish, and a boat." That was all he had to say.
And yet, you know, the thing about Hemingway is you'd be surprised if you go to people who say that they don't read, which is a lot of Americans, even though it's probably not a lot of our listeners. So listeners, go do this. Ask people, you know, find somebody who doesn't read and then ask them if there's anything that they did like reading that they were forced to read. Mm-hmm. I find Hemingway is one of those authors that ends up popping up among people who are like, "I don't read, but I was forced to read, you know, a little bit in school," and that Hemingway guy, you know, they read a short story, or they read The Old Man in the Sea, or one of these other ones. Yeah. And it sticks.
Yeah. No, he's really good. I would highly recommend A Farewell to Arms. Really, really, really good. So on that note, we're going to switch to our spotlight. Although honestly, this whole episode was a spotlight. So that category is getting nixed for this podcast. Sorry.
Well, I'll give some, more detail. Yeah, yeah.
Go so, pre-order this book. Yes. We want people reading this book. Don't just listen to the episode.
Go Colin's get the getting book. Desperate, folks. He wants the sales, and
I'm not Thomas Traherne hoping to die with a hat and a walking stick. I am trying to make money on this podcast.
He knows that the goods of the soul are necessary to happiness. Bodily goods are fitting, but man, you know.
But cash.
Does that you know, fit feel
fame.
Good?
That's what we're after here on the podcast.
All right, Reese.
Why the details, I am then. So great
Freddy,
is going to Freddy be my
more,
next novel.
Yeah, formal details. This should come out, I think, this will come out, well, the 16th of January right now. It'll come out a week from today. Come out by the end of January. The book is due out on the 9th of February, 2023. Christian Ethics, Volume 1, The Shining Human Creature. The link will be in the show notes, or you can go to the Davenant Institute website and find it there. Or if you're listening to this after the book's come out, it's out. Go to the Davenant Institute website or to Amazon, wherever you are, because all of our printing is done by Amazon KDP, and you can order it there. And it's quite a short book. It's 120-ish pages.
It's a book that values your time and attention.
Mm. Yes, it's like Hemingway. It's very cleanly, neatly written.
Okay,
not in the same style as Hemingway, I'll definitely say that.
Okay. It's better than Hemingway, actually. That's what reason.
Give it to people who
say.
Don't read.
So this podcast was going really well, and then the plane just starts descending, and then you realize it's not a controlled descent, and the crash just happened, ladies and gentlemen. All right, so if you like plane crashes, give this podcast a 5-star review on iTunes. But if they didn't like the podcast, Colin, what should they do?
You should just buy my book. Anyone who buys this book, I'll give it to you. This is an easy one this week. Normally, I give you something real hard to do. This week, if you buy my book, you're free to give us a 1-star review.
All right. Well, on that note, we are the editors. This is the Ad Fontes podcast, and we will see you next week.